Good evening.
Good evening.
We have two new faces here tonight. You're both from the school, or you're from?
From what?
From Santa Clara?
University? No.
We were expecting a whole group from the Santa Clara University. So, you've been here before.
Yeah, I live near here on occasion.
Yes, you're familiar. And you just dropped in.
I just dropped in.
Welcome.
Is this
Google? I see. Not at Santa Clara at all.
I think I'm too, well, I guess there's not that age for Santa Clara.
No, not anymore.
No.
Well, let's do introductions around.
Wendy.
Isaiah.
Jeffrey.
Ross.
Julie.
Paul.
Ellie.
Carolyn.
Ron.
And Angie. And this is the Carolyn that I was telling you about, who is rejoining us in a wonderful way, in several different ways, which is really special. And I think we're going to enjoy this new era a lot. In any case, you're very welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to see you back. So what we're studying is the Heart Sutra, which is what we just chanted, which is an essential piece of Zen. You might say it's the only really essential thing that we say over and over. We say it at weddings, at funerals, baby blessings, all kinds of anything that we need something to say, we say the Heart Sutra. I have a friend who carries a little shovel in the back of his van, and whenever he comes across an animal that's been killed on the road, he stops, buries it, and chants the Heart Sutra over it. It's a kind of protection that doesn't require total understanding, because you can't understand it. It's trying to express in words what is really untalkaboutable. What we do is an experience. What we feel is something very deep and very vital, but it's very, very hard to talk about it in words. It's beyond words, or under words, or inside words, and words can't touch it, but they can point to it. And if we're open to the words, then we can find a way to see more clearly what the words, or feel more clearly and more deeply what the words are trying to say, but not quite saying. I've been plunging into red pine, and I've been encouraging you all to have a copy of this if you can. It's a curious, actually, I find it kind of curious. He has all kinds of suppositions that he keeps throwing in there about the meaning of things, and he throws in tantric practices and understandings about the womb of prajna, and things that just don't sound like anything that I ever heard my teacher say at all. It's really a lot of extra, I would say, in here. But it's also extremely helpful, and he quotes a lot of teachers besides himself, ancient Chinese teachers mostly. And their commentaries are the little paragraphs that he throws in all through there are extremely helpful also. So I thought instead of reading the whole thing that I would try to do what I did before with the Lojong and just go through pieces of it and pull out the things that I want to talk about and open it up so that you all can pull out things to talk about too, if that's okay, rather than reading it word for word all the way through. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
No, Ron?
It makes sense. And it doesn't make sense, but it points to sense.
Okay. All right.
That was a clever.
I get it.
But it's good. It's a good way to do it.
Okay. It worked with the Lojong, so let's see if it'll work here. So he starts out with the meaning of prajna. And the actual meaning of it is before knowing. So it's just what I was describing. We can't know it in this intellectual sense of it. It's what comes before we know it, when we sense it, intuit it. It's what he says Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind. And so, although some of us have been sitting for many, many years, every time we sit down, it's new. Every time we start anything, it's new. It's the most merciful thing about human life that we get to start over and over. We're never done. And if we mess up one way or one time, we can always start over and do it again. And certainly in our practice, we just do it and then do it some more and then do it some more. And it always calls us back. Sometimes we wander off for a while, but there is something that once we taste the sit, it calls us home again. Because in sitting, we return home. So the basis of this whole little sutra is again the same thing that we've been studying over and over again about the self, about the reality and the unreality of the self. We all come into the world and take on a self, a name and a history and a memory and a whole life with a capital L. And without looking deeply into how it actually works, it seems like it's a solid thing, a solid, unchangeable something that's called me. And so Zen practice is about looking deeply and experiencing the question about what is this? What is this really? And then beginning to examine little bit by little bit how it comes to be that we think it's a solid thing, when the fact is that we aren't at all like we were 10 years ago, any of us. We're really different. And speaking of 10 years ago, that's nothing considering some of us, like me, who go back many, many more years than that. So, believe it or not, I was once a 5-pound baby. It's really hard to believe. I don't believe it, but that's what they tell me.
Wow. Well, it says it on your birth certificate.
Yes,
right?
Yes, it does. And you too might have spent your first months in a drawer, you know, as a tiny, tiny baby. And look at us now. Calluses and wrinkles. And that's just a little piece of it. Just a tiny bit of it. So the Heart Sutra is pointing us to that in very specific ways, very particular ways of how to look at this life, this body life, this mind life, how to examine it closely, and how to see how indeterminate it is, and how once it's understood as not fixed, as not having to bludgeon us with its reality, that we can be more free to move and breathe and think and do than we can when we're tangled up with a self. So this is about achieving freedom from that entanglement. So he talks about three kinds of wisdom. Ordinary mundane wisdom, metaphysical wisdom, and transcendent wisdom. But he says nothing can be characterized as permanent, pure, or having a self. And yet neither can anything be characterized as impermanent, or impure, or lacking a self. Once you start talking about it and thinking about it, you have to realize that it's just words. It's just thoughts. It's just gobbledygook in a way. It is this. No, it's not this. It's this. No, but it can't be that. And at the same time, you know, the fan is turning around and the light is shining and we're sitting here quietly and it's a lovely evening. So, he quotes an old Chinese teacher who says, what is the meaning of prajna in the title of this sutra? This is Sanskrit for wisdom. And what is the meaning of paramita? This is also Sanskrit and means to reach the other shore. The meaning is that the suffering of samsara, samsara being this world of sharp edges and hardship. The meaning of paramita is also Sanskrit and means to reach the other shore. The meaning is that the suffering of samsara is like a great ocean, and the desires and thoughts of beings are boundless. Ignorant and unaware, their waves of consciousness swell and give rise to doubt and karma, and the cycle of birth and death, to bitterness that has no limit and from which they cannot escape. This is what is meant by this shore. The Buddha used the light of great wisdom to shine through the dust of desire and to put an end to suffering once and all. To cross the sea of samsara and to realize nirvana is what is meant by the other shore. This is a very old and tried image of crossing over. It's a kind of labor that we enter as we sit until finally we begin to realize that the place we left is the place we've come to. But they say it's like the mountains are the mountains when we begin, and the mountains are the same mountains when we end, but they are experienced in a little different way. There's no place to go. We're stuck. Which is a good thing. So he goes into the meaning of sutra. But I'd like to get to Avalokiteshvara. Because that's the very first word in the sutra. And Avalokiteshvara is the word for compassion, the bodhisattva of compassion. The bodhisattva with many hands and many eyes, always ready to hear a cry of distress and go. Always prepared to go. It sounds a little esoteric until we think of how our life really unfolds, and we meet Avalokiteshvara endlessly, so many times a day. The people who help us, the things that help us, the food that feeds us, all of that is a compassionate encounter, our life with life. Life in its warmth and its nourishment and its capacity for compassion. The world is infused with it, even in the worst circumstances. Compassion is always here. There's another version, the Tibetan version, that starts out with a little story about Buddha teaching on a high place and then starts into the Avalokiteshvara. But in Zen, we just cut all that off and just plunge in. The term bodhisattva, says Red Pine, is usually explained as a being of enlightenment. Sattva means someone, and bodhi means enlightenment. Koben actually surprised us when we wanted to incorporate many, many years ago, and he decided that we would call our tiny sangha bodhi. And we said, "Oh, teacher, what does that mean?" And he said, "Oh, it means enlightenment." Us, meaning us, enlightenment. But it was also a huge encouragement to us to think Bodhi, that we were called Bodhi for a little while. At least for the state of California, we incorporated that way.
Bodhi Incorporated.
Bodhi Inc. Yes, and wow. You had to say how many members you have, and Koben said, "We have to put in all beings are members of our sangha," and they accepted it. So that's a wonderful beginning, and I hope we can keep that mind wide awake and alive. It's really important. That's the truth of it. So Red Pine points out an interesting thing, that using bodhisattva is a new word for people practicing, because in the earlier days, people practiced in order to get enlightened. And the new thought was that a bodhisattva would practice to be with people and help them get enlightened first. And only when everybody was on the other shore, so-called, then the bodhisattva would carry on into Buddhahood, I guess. Someone said it's like filling a well with snow. It's a sort of impossible task. And I've always thought, maybe so, maybe not, but it's a wonderful way of thinking about our life, that if there's coming back, then we vow to come back and just keep on helping. So it means that we're not going to look forward to being done anytime soon. And even if we are done, we don't know. So it gives our life new meaning, more meaning, to think that if it does go on, I'll be back. I'll do it all over again. Which is a big deal. It's not nothing. So instead of having that goal of enlightenment, the bodhisattvas of all the bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara is probably the number one. There are several that sit beside Buddha in all the statues. You'll see the bodhisattvas on either side of Buddha, and they're his support. There are lots of myths, stories about them. But the idea of compassion is the reality. So some people chant the Lotus Sutra, just the name of it. Some people chant Avalokiteshvara, just its name. Some people pray to Avalokiteshvara. To many, many Vietnamese, when they were crossing in their little boats to escape, prayed to Avalokiteshvara. I know one woman who is sure that she was saved that way. Dogen Zenji also, when he was crossing over, a great teacher in Japan, went through a terrible storm, and he always said that Avalokiteshvara was the only thing that saved them. It's how our mind works. There's a lot of history here, but maybe that's enough. Fatsang says about Avalokiteshvara, this name is given to someone who has the power to see without being obstructed by concepts or objects, and whose power to see how to aid those who hope to be rescued is also unobstructed. And there was one more. No, that's... There are many, many statues of Avalokiteshvara. You'll see sitting on a lotus, holding the Lotus Sutra often, holding this, or the Heart Sutra, the Lotus Sutra. There's a wonderful collection of statues, all the same size, human size, 108 of them, all lined up like on bleachers. Standing in each one is holding a different instrument in her hand. So one has a knife and one has a spoon and one has a saw and one has an infinite number of things to, just in case somebody calls for help. So you must have questions and more to add. Paul.
I'm curious, Avalokiteshvara, in China, would that be Kuan Yin?
That's a version of it, yes.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
She has a thousand arms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And Tara is another version of it, the 16-year-old girl who is sitting like this with one leg up, ready to leap, because she's young and can do that. So there are a lot of versions. And it's often, in the old versions, a he, and some of them are obviously both. There's a little swelling on one side, and that's really man's chest on the other side with the robes in between, and you can see it's qualified, you know, in a very nice. There's a beautiful statue in Kansas City that you might have seen the poster that they put out, this golden, beautiful Avalokiteshvara.
So Kando is another expression?
Yes. Yes. When Kogan named Jikoji, he named Kando. And then he named Jikoji compassion. Light. Compassion, light. Ji is compassion and Ko is light. So he just skipped all of it, went straight to the source. And Hokoji is wisdom light. So he obviously was thinking about what he was doing. Carolyn?
So when I was reading this, I haven't read again, just what you've read, gotten that far, but I was struck by Red Pine's use of terms. He can be very careful, but he kept using the term transcendent for transcendent wisdom, and that's,
yeah,
I think, a bit problematic for me and for others who have a, you know, have a background in Western history, philosophy, religion, etc. It has a very specific meaning, transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
And he does qualify in there. He keeps using that word, but he does qualify by going through the translation of just gone beyond. And so for myself, I like to, I guess a word that resonates more with me is one that you used earlier of intuit, what we intuit,
yes,
in a way.
Yes.
So it's not that we're a transcendent, and this kind of sounds like we're going, you know, to
going
some
up.
Heaven. Yeah, going up and yeah, going to some realm of where everything's going to be
perfect.
Perfect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No way. It doesn't work like that.
So that kind of wisdom, you know, that's just the wisdom that prajna is, that transcendence.
Yes.
For me, is more like what we can each experience in different ways at different times.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's the Buddha's whole point. Was he touched the ground when he was enlightened. He was not transcending. That's what the other practice was, that he had tried so hard and it doesn't work. You transcend for a little while and then you get up and you're just the same as you were before.
Or you're about dead.
Yeah, until you're about dead. That's what he did.
Buddha nearly killed himself.
It sure did. He sure did. So it doesn't work, and it's the wrong direction. The earth is where we belong. This is it. This is our heaven.
Mm-hmm.
This is our Eden. We think we were kicked out, but It's a mind trick.
Well, the words are imperfect. Sometimes just try to think of the. I think of it not by putting English grammar rules or parts of speech rules on it. So I would say something like prajna is wisdom, and para is gone beyond, or we say paranormal, para above, and nitya is, I guess, the shore for wisdom gone beyond, but it doesn't necessarily have any physical orientation or spatial orientation.
No, it doesn't, does it?
But we'll say transcendent. If we studied American, philosophy, all the transcendentalists.
Yes.
To have their own thing. Which wasn't that far away.
Well, they were
a different take on it.
Yes. They were inspired by Buddhism a little bit.
Well, sometimes I try to just look at literal, the literal sense and kind of turn that around in my own way.
Yes.
But it doesn't have the same, grammatical connection that we usually want to use in English.
Well, everything is new in English. Everything is being translated and retranslated and trying to bring it into some sort of focus. It came through India to China and to Vietnam and to Korea and Burma and et cetera. And then Japan, and now we have it from Japan and China and Burma and Korea and et cetera. So trying to intuit what this is requires practice. I always say it's like reading about swimming when you haven't been in the water. You have to be in the water and swim a lot before you even want to read about it. The main thing is the experience itself. And once the experience becomes a part of your life, then you become curious and want to know more. And probably should know more where it comes from, because we are sitting really in the laps of our ancestors, all the women and men who brought this to us through the centuries, kept it alive as a live thing, experience of mind and body, and mind and body dropping off, conveying it all the way to here for us. Paul?
One old master said that not knowing was most intimate.
Yes.
This is an intimate practice.
Yes.
Not a knowing practice.
Exactly. Yes. It can't be known. Carolyn?
I've read Pine quotes one of the Chinese masters, and I don't remember which one, but as saying about the words and about knowing in that way, that this is just, that this is another kind of almost, this master put it almost in terms as the Heart Sutra does, these pairs of seeing mm-hmm. paradoxes, if you will, and says that the words are there to point us, as you said, and to encourage us.
Yes.
The words. He also says we can't know it through words, but we can't do without the words. So that's
a good point.
That paradox.
Yes, it is.
That he brings up.
It is. I often tell people who are new to sitting to not try to read for a while, because it doesn't help. It just seems like gobbledygook until the experience becomes familiar. And there are times in my life when I just stopped reading and just kept sitting for a long time. And now I'm reading voraciously. I love it all of a sudden. So you just never know. Well, it's 8 o'clock, I'm sorry to say. But there's more next week. So, are there announcements? There's a sit coming up.
Yes, Saturday the 14th, a full day sit here, 9 to 4.
Bring a lunch, or go out to lunch around here, such as it is. Okay, we'll have a 1 minute sit.